Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ruth Knocker, and I'm joined today by Julia and Adam, my colleagues. We'd like to kick things off with a welcome to country from Auntie Manya.
Ngangamalari, I'm Aunty Manya, and on behalf of Dentons and everyone here today, I would like to recognise the stories, traditions, and living cultures of the land on which we meet. We acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land and their continued connections to land, sea, and community. And we pay our respects to elders past and present. Ngangamalari.
Well, welcome everybody. So we hear expressions like workplace culture or our values from our clients regularly, and often it comes up in the context of employers wanting to address employee complaints, terminate employment, ask us to conduct investigations. More recently, we've also been asked to speak to senior leaders, including the board. About perceptions that an organization's employees are unhappy, not working well together, or making complaints. And so, given this context, we thought it would be a good idea to chat to you today about workplace cultural issues. Because often when we are asked to be involved in investigations or giving advice, it's actually a reflection of the fact that there's been poor workplace culture, employee bad behaviour has been going on for some time and it's been left unchecked. So we wanted to explore this concept today of what is workplace culture, how to improve workplace culture, and also look at the way in which employee bad behaviour contributes to workplace culture. We'll also be looking at some of the risks that arise from a poor workplace culture. Including some of employee type claims and health and safety issues. We will also look at some of the hidden indications in your workplaces of poor culture and risks from bad behaviour. We'll also look at legal obligations, whose role it is to address bad behaviour, what can be done. And are there any legal impediments to be mindful of when introducing measures to implement cultural change? So, looking first of all at workplace culture, it can be a bit of a nebulous concept. It will mean different things between different organisations. The main thing is to work out what it means for your organisation and people, and to have an understanding of what makes a good workplace culture as opposed to a poor one. A useful description of workplace culture is the way we do things and what creates, drives, and sustains us as an organisation. Different workplaces will have a different emphasis on different values, and that will often be a reflection of the type of work that an organisation is involved in. So, for example, if you are a mine or a construction company, obviously performing work safely is and following safety systems is going to be of greater importance for your organization. Some organizations will value hierarchical structures, others will value widely collaborative workplaces. It's usual for organizations to look to tie their values to their culture. It's also workplace culture is important because it's what makes people enjoy their workplaces. Often people can cynically think that the only thing that makes people enjoy their work is how much they are paid. But it's apparent that often an employee's reason to stay at a particular workplace is because they enjoy, or what attracts someone to a particular workplace is because they enjoy the culture of that particular workplace. Concepts such as diversity, inclusivity, employees feeling valued, these are all part of a workplace culture. It's also important that health and safety and the well-being of employees, and a commitment to training and employee development. These will also be important aspects of workplace culture. What is important in terms of defining workplace culture is putting some effort into defining it and involving employees in that process, understanding from your employees what they enjoy about their particular workplace, what's important to them, and their understanding of an organisation's values. So in terms of where the workplace culture is reflected, if there is a poor workplace culture, that can often be reflected in the communication between employees. And this communication extends to the way in which employees email each other or communicate with each other on sort of Teams or Slack. Also communication in the office. So how do people treat each other or speak to each other during meetings? But also if you're in open plan offices, how do people communicate with each other in those open environments? Often we see that when we're conducting investigations, that the conversations that are allowed to go on in open plans can often form a part of employee complaints that relate to issues like discrimination and also bullying. In addition, in terms of communication between employees, is it the type of workplace where gossip is tolerated, or employees are allowed to, or managers regularly engage in dressing down employees? It's done in an open environment, so other people are witness to those sorts of things. This will all be, these types of issues can be reflected in a poor workplace culture. In addition to that, internal promotions and recognition. As an organisation, are you looking to recognise employees who exhibit the organisation's values or demonstrate a positive workplace culture? Or is it the kind of workplace where, despite the fact that there may have been employee grievances or complaints against a particular manager, nevertheless, that manager is consistently promoted? Participation in meetings can also be a reflection of the workplace culture. In particular, not only is that about the way in which people talk to one another, but are people actually participating in meetings? If people are consistently attending meetings and not speaking up, not asking questions, not taking an interest, this could be a reflection of a poor workplace culture. Social events will also be an important part of any workplace culture, in particular if it is a very social office. What is happening at those social events? Increasingly, we're seeing that there are risks, the risks that are arising from social events where excessive drinking is tolerated. That could be a problem. Who are the people who are attending the social events? Is it something that's pretty exclusive? So perhaps there are a lot of social events, but only 20% of your workforce are attending them. Are there issues that are arising from those social events in terms of employee bad behaviour? If you have in your organisation, if there is a lot of working from home, then that is also something that will need to be factored into any thoughts around and approaches to workplace culture, because of the fact that people won't be coming into the office and having that interaction. Their interaction will largely be a bit more structured because they will be working from home. And so therefore you need to factor that in when you're thinking about workplace culture and how to improve it. And another aspect of workplace culture can be management of employee complaints. We see this consistently from our clients that employees, where there is a poor workplace culture, employees are either too scared to complain, or they raise concerns about the fact that they have made complaints or their colleagues have made complaints and nothing has been done about it. So, what is the point of making a complaint? Or people fear that they will be victimised as a result of making a complaint. So all of these sorts of things are behaviours, to be aware of in your office, which will be a reflection of your workplace culture. It's a sign that some steps need to be taken to improve it. So, Julia, if I'm the director of people and culture of an organisation, how do I ascertain if there is a poor workplace culture?
Yeah, Ruth, there are a few signs that sort of demonstrate that an organisation might be suffering from poor workplace culture. A few of the primary ones are things like, you know, high staff turnover, increased levels of absenteeism, you know, more references to employees taking stress leave or wanting to work from home more often, increases in complaints about bullying, discrimination, harassment. All those sorts of topics are also a good indicator that there might be some culture concerns within an organization. On top of that, we also have things like increases in internal or interpersonal sort of disputes between workers, hostility between individuals in the workplace, and even an increase in WHS incidents and workers' compensation claims could all be indicators that there may be some underlying culture concerns, and they should be sort of things that that the employers really should start looking at, or indicators that indicate at the beginning that there is potentially some underlying concern.
Thanks, Julia. I think one of the important things to remember in terms of signs of a poor workplace culture is that it's important to be on the lookout early. So, encouraging your managers to be on the lookout for things like gossip in the office, employees perhaps not getting along, disgruntled workers. It's important to be able to address those issues early, because snoozing on poor cultural issues are the types of things that then lead to bullying complaints or WHS risks further down the track. And by the time you are at that point, when you're looking at workplace investigations and those sorts of things, it becomes a lot more expensive to address as an organisation. And so, Adam, workplace cultural issues can sometimes seem a little daunting to fix because it involves human beings, also involves a number of employees. What are some of the things that can be done to change a workplace culture?
Well, according to Safe Work Australia, Ruth, workplace culture is made up of two aspects: the values and behaviours of workers and the shared attitudes and beliefs in the workplace's written and unwritten rules. And people in leadership positions at work play a key role in fostering a positive workplace culture. Leaders can include the board, senior executives, middle-level managers and team leaders. When leaders promote WHS compliance and encourage workers to report WHS issues, this protects workers' physical and mental well-being and in turn improves workplace culture. Leaders have a critical role in promoting WHS compliance. Although they may not know it, leaders influence other workers' attitudes and behaviours. This can be done explicitly, for example, by implementing formal anti-bullying policies and rolling mandatory anti-bullying training to workers, or more subtly, for example, by leaders consistently role modeling appropriate behavior and offering support to subordinates. For example, following allegations of misuse of power, sexual harassment, and other inappropriate behavior, Nine Entertainment engaged an independent review of its workplace practices and culture. Some of the findings of the review included that 57% of broadcast division workers reported experiencing bullying, discrimination, or harassment, and experiences of public humiliation, white-anting, belittling comments or conduct, and aggressive or intimidating behavior were normalized. Leaders at Nine, rather than identifying and addressing these clear WHS concerns, were found to have engaged in and perpetuated these inappropriate behaviors. The review found that the overall poor workplace culture at Nine was underpinned and enabled by many factors, including a lack of leadership accountability. When leaders explicitly and implicitly promote WHS compliance and accountability, workers in the organisation become more likely to also comply with WHS policies and procedures and feel more comfortable raising any WHS concerns with their employer. Strong compliance with WHS laws and regulation in turn contributes to fostering a positive workplace culture. It's important to remember that efforts to improve workplace culture won't always have its intended effect immediately. It's a long game. An interesting example of a large global organization that recently made the decision to improve its workplace culture is Rio Tinto. In 2022, Rio Tinto engaged Elizabeth Broderick, the former Australian Sex Discrimination Commissioner, to conduct an external review of its workplace culture. She released a report in 2022, which identified the workplace challenges at Rio Tinto, including bullying, sexual harassment, racism, and other forms of discrimination, and made 26 recommendations to improve Rio Tinto's workplace culture with a view to achieving sustained cultural change. In 2024, Elizabeth Broderick released a progress review, which assessed Rio Tinto's workplace culture 2 years later. This review revealed that despite the implementation of the 26 recommendations, workers at Rio Tinto were continuing to experience high rates of bullying and harassment. Reports of bullying in particular were higher in 2024 than in 2022. For example, in 2022, 36% of women said they were bullied, but in 2024, 50% of women said they were bullied. The progress review states that higher rates of bullying can be explained by increasing retaliation in the form of gendered bullying as a response to Rio Tinto's efforts to promote gender diversity and inclusion. Some male employees at Rio Tinto worryingly expressed that Rio Tinto's workplace culture revamp had caused reverse discrimination and that women who are not qualified were being hired. There was specific resistance to programs and strategies targeted at women and other marginalized groups, including leadership programs. However, the overall results of the review, according to Broderick, should be understood within the broader context of change. Resistance to change is a normal part of the cultural change process, but with sustained focus, Rio Tinto should expect to see positive change in its workplace culture over time.
Thanks, Adam. I mean, I think another thing that would explain that increase in the number of bullying complaints is that if you're creating a culture where people are encouraged to come forward and speak about issues that they're facing at work, that could also cause an increase in complaints. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the behaviour is getting worse. I think the other thing that's interesting in relation to that is Rio Tinto being prepared to publish that report and make that available to other employers to review, to sort of demonstrate their experience of trying to improve workplace culture. I think sort of that degree of transparency provides some useful lessons for other organisations who are looking to go through change in their workplace culture. So there's a lot that can contribute to a positive workplace culture. So things like, you know, remuneration schemes, rewarding employees, training, commitment to education. But at the same time, and probably actually more influential, is poor employee behaviour as a contributor to workplace. So it's more influential, or can be more influential on workplace culture, particularly if that poor employee behaviour is tolerated. So, Julia, what are some of the examples of employee bad behaviour that we regularly see in workplaces in when we're advising our clients?
Yeah, Ruth, I mean, on the slides, we've included some of the most common examples of poor behaviour that we see in our day-to-day practice. I won't go through all of them in great detail, but just to talk through a few of some of the more prevalent examples. We have bullying and harassment. Research has found that bullying affects at least one third of workers through either direct exposure or indirectly. So that's employees just being a witness to bullying conduct in the workplace. Bullying can include a range of behaviours, and it can manifest either verbally, physically, or through body language. You know, some examples include making repeated hurtful remarks or making fun of someone's work or an aspect of their identity, excluding people in the workplace, intimidation, belittling, even physical contact, pushing, shoving, grabbing people. And something that might be a little bit more prevalent is also written bullying, either through email or on social media, and general sort of aggressive conduct. So the important thing to also remember about bullying itself from a legal perspective is for this type of conduct to be deemed bullying, especially under the Fair Work Act, it needs to be repeated. So one-off instances may very well amount to inappropriate workplace behaviour, but it won't actually meet the threshold of bullying under the Fair Work Act. But again, that doesn't mean that it's not an example of employee bad behaviour. Sexual harassment is also, unfortunately, another example of bad behaviour that's all too common in workplaces. You know, sexual harassment is unwelcome sexual behaviour that would cause a reasonable person to feel offended, humiliated, or intimidated. And the intention of the alleged harasser doesn't matter. So it's all based on what a reasonable person in the same situation would be feeling. It also, similarly to bullying, can include physical forms such as, you know, unwanted touching, sexual propositions, and sexual assault, but also non-physical forms. Such as, you know, displaying offensive materials in the workplace, leering, making offensive comments or gestures towards other employees as well. And in terms of who the research shows experiences and perpetrates sexual harassment in the workplace, studies are overwhelmingly showing us that most reports in the workplace are by women and concern harassment by men. To give you a little statistic, you know, around 85% of complaints are filed by women and 15% by men. And the targets of sexual harassment in the workplace are usually often vulnerable people. So, you know, young women, women in non-traditional jobs or male-dominated fields, Indigenous and First Nations women, women with disabilities or from culturally and linguistically diverse communities, and also in general, just members of the LGBTQI community. We also know that sexual harassment is more prevalent in organisations where there is a low acceptance of the challenges of balancing work and family life, or where sort of the culture is performance oriented more than employee oriented. So that also is, links a little bit to the culture of a workplace and how the culture of the workplace may impact the likelihood of this type of conduct really occurring. Another example that we have seen is, of course, racism. It can take many forms. It includes prejudice, discrimination, or hatred directed at someone because of their color, ethnicity, or national origin. It is often revealed through people's actions as well as their attitudes. And everyday racism is something that can be quite prevalent in the workplaces to some extent. And that's something that basically reinforces negative stereotypes or prejudices about people based on their race, color, or ethnicity. And we often most often see it through offhand jokes or comments. So, you know, for example, it might be a comment that an Indigenous or First Nations person has fair skin, or relying on assumptions and stereotypes, you know, such as assumptions about work ethic, or assumptions that a person has only got the job because of their race. So that's another sort of prevalent example of employee bad behaviour. We've also got workplace violence and aggression, and that basically encompasses any incident where a person is abused or threatened or assaulted at work. It can include things like physical assault, hitting, grabbing, throwing objects, behavior that can create a fear of violence, such as, you know, verbal threats, yelling, swearing, even hazing or initiation of new employees would come under that sort of umbrella of workplace violence and aggression. And while the risk of violent or aggressive behaviour can occur in any industry. Recent research from Safe Work Australia has found that it is most common in industries where people work with the public or external clients. So it's not necessarily happening between employees or workers themselves, but external stakeholders that might be involved in the business. So higher risk industries we know include things like healthcare and social assistance services. So nurses, paramedics, child protection workers, residential and home carers, also people working in public administration and safety. So police officers, security guards, and also retail trade and food services. And in particular, young workers that are working in those industries. And finally, it's quite prevalent in education and training. So including teachers and teachers' aides, basically any kind of role where there is that interaction with external stakeholders. And the final sort of example that I'll touch on this afternoon is employees' poor behaviour on social media. It's always a bit of a topical discussion. And we do have a recent case study to illustrate some of the effects of employees using social media inappropriately in the workplace. So this was an unfair dismissal decision from 2024 that confirmed, other than being a valid reason for termination, that an employee's poor conduct on social media has the ability to negatively impact relationships in the workplace. So the employee in this case was employed as a bar supervisor for the Dolphin Hotel in Sydney. The employee in October attended a meeting in which the employer stated that a focus needed to be placed on being seen as one team, and that supervisors need to be seen to be supporting management decisions. Now, not long after this meeting, the employer received reports that the particular employee had criticized the management team in a group chat on Facebook. And that group chat was set up by employees to discuss events and matters relating to work. The employee was counseled about that conduct, and despite that, she continued to vent her own opinions about management on the group chat. She also began excluding managers from this group chat. So managers would try to join or be added, she would remove them. And when she would do so, she would send a message in the chat basically saying that it was a management-free space for employees to vent and that she wanted it to stay that way. The employee basically repeatedly used the group chat to express negative opinions about management and also encouraged others and other employees to communicate their frustrations as well. Now, all of this conduct really built up over a few months, and the employer became concerned that the comments in the group chats were inciting a negative and combative environment amongst the team, and that the comments were encouraging negativity towards management. So it was having a flow-on effect to employees within the workplace itself, even though the comments were being made on a social media platform. The employee was eventually dismissed from her employment due to her conduct in the group chats, and the employer alleged that her conduct had created a divisive atmosphere between staff and management. So the Fair Work Commission found that the Dolphin Hotel did have a valid reason for terminating her employment, and the commission considered that the employee's conduct in online chats was particularly inappropriate given that she did hold a supervisory position, and she had only just attended the meeting where the employer set very clear expectations about needing to be seen as one team and support and supporting management decisions. So this decision is really a key reminder for employers that poor workplace behaviour can extend to conduct outside of the workplace and on social media, and that that conduct, even though it may not be physically occurring in the workplace, has the ability to impact work environments and negatively affect relationships between employees and management. So now that we've gone through some of the common examples of poor workplace behaviour, what are some of the risks that we see arising from this kind of behaviour for employers? So we've categorised the risks into four main categories: impacts to mental and physical health, workplace related risks, increase in disciplinary matters and employee claims, as well as reputational risks. So starting with some of the impacts we see to mental and physical health of employees, I mean, the effects of bullying and sexual harassment or aggressive behavior, they can be profound and long lasting. They include significant psychological effects, you know, things such as anxiety, depression, stress, fear, shame, lowered self-esteem and confidence, feelings of isolation, and even in extreme cases, suicidal ideation. They can also manifest in more physical forms, such as severe weight gain or weight loss, sleep disorders, and just general decreases in physical health. These things don't only impact people who are the subject of poor workplace behavior or the subject of the bullying or the harassment, but also employees who regularly witness this behavior occurring. And that's something that's really important for employers to remember. And it's really important for employers to keep an eye on these effects, as they do link into your obligation to prevent psychosocial hazards in the workplace as well. But apart from the physical impacts, there are also several workplace related risks. These include things like reduced productivity or engagement with work tasks. When an employee feels unsafe or uncomfortable at work, they're less likely to be engaged in their work and their performance might start to suffer. There's also an increased risk of workplace accidents, particularly if employees are distracted or aren't following appropriate WHS protocols, decreases in morale and job satisfaction, increased levels of absenteeism is something that we see quite often, you know, that's more employees taking long-term sick leave or requesting to work from home more often or referring to sick leave as stress leave. Those are all long-term or, you know, long-term effects of poor employee behavior. And also damage to interpersonal relationships at work. You know, trust and teamwork in the workplace can be compromised when employees are either subject to or witness poor behavior by colleagues. And these work-related risks could then also lead to an increase in disciplinary matters and employee claims. So everything's pretty linked in this sphere. You know, there may be an increased need for internal disciplinary processes and management of disputes procedures. You know, this might be more investigations into complaints or a higher need for management of disciplinary processes that result in warnings or a termination process. And this in itself will place a higher burden on managers and people and culture teams as well. But employee bad behavior also causes an increased risk of employee litigation. You know, things like bullying claims, workers' compensation claims, discrimination claims, which will all cause employers to no doubt incur costs and things that flow on from those types of claims. There's also the risk of intervention by an external regulatory authority. So things like the relevant safe work body or tribunal, such as the AHRC or the Fair Work Commission, may intervene. And, you know, it just links back to the increased risk of claims and regulatory penalties as well. And the last sort of option we have there on the slide is reputational risk. Now, this is largely self-explanatory, but, you know, of course, suffering reputational damage, if your organization has a reputation of poor workplace culture, it'll of course have flow-on effects to, you know, the organization's ability to retain and win clients, retain and onboard, you know, good and long-standing employees, or also even, you know, develop relationships within the industry in which they operate. So those are just a few of the sort of risks that we see of employee bad behavior.
Thanks, Julia. So in terms of, if you're an organization and you have seen this list of risks to your organization, you perhaps don't have a great read on whether there are any concerns with your workplace culture, or perhaps you've received some kind of anonymous complaint where someone has alluded to issues with workplace culture but doesn't provide any specifics. What can you, as an organisation, what are some practical tips for ascertaining whether there is an issue with your workplace culture or whether there is perhaps some employee bad behaviour that's going on and you're not aware of it because employees aren't making complaints about it? So the slide here has a few recommendations. So some of the more obvious ones are if you do an audit of your claims, employee complaints, bullying claims, this should identify for you whether there are any repeat offenders, and whether there people are coming forward and making complaints about. It could be against complaints about specific employees, but with this the focus on psychosocial hazards in workplaces. This will also identify for you where there are problems with the way in which work is structured. So it's not especially about all the issues that are causing harm to workplace culture are not necessarily related to employee bad behavior, but just the way in which work is structured or the way in which people are permitted to communicate with one another. It might not be a particularly transparent culture. It may be one where there's a lot of sort of infighting, gossiping, those sorts of things. Not one single person is contributing, but the overall effect of it is creating risk to people's mental health. You can also look at attrition rates, although attrition rates, it's a bit of a blunt instrument and will depend on the particular industry you're in. In some industries, attrition rates might be particularly, say, if you've got an industry where it's quite normal for people to have their first job go for 3 or 4 years and then move on to another organisation, but that's something that is encouraged in, say, the particular profession that people move from job to job, then attrition rates might not necessarily be reflective of poor culture. One way to really to ascertain whether people, employees are happy, and to identify any concerns that employees have in their workplace will be to get feedback from employees. And this can be sort of, I guess, cost-effective versions where you get anonymous surveys that you distribute to employees and ask them to complete. You can also engage culture experts, which is sort of more of a Rolls-Royce treatment at the other end, where usually these consultants can come in and conduct surveys, small group chats with employees, and it really is a sort of digging in deep to work out whether or not your workplace culture is as productive as it can be and what can be done to change it. Another useful source of information about workplace culture and employee bad behaviour is exit interviews, because people will tend to be very frank when they are leaving an organisation because they're of the view that there's no consequences for them in speaking their mind on their way out the door. But all of these things are sort of measures that you can implement across an organisation to sort of really ascertain where the culture is at, but also that you in your organisations encourage your people, that if you've got managers, your HR team, get feedback from your HR team, encourage people to be proactive and to be observant at what is going on in the workplace. That can be just as effective as any other tool for working out whether or not people are happy. We can all, in an organisation, if there is sort of a lot of gossip going on in the workplace or conversations going on that are likely to exclude particular individuals, encouraging a culture where people are observing that sort of behaviour, and that can be an important means of identifying problems in a workplace culture rather than just waiting for a bullying claim to come in, because often by the time a bullying claim comes in, we've had an extended period of time of poor behaviour that has been corroding the workplace culture. So, putting the director of HR hat on again, Adam, who's is it just the is it just my job to look after workplace culture and to implement change, or are there responsibilities, particularly legal responsibilities, across the board for employee poor behaviour and workplace culture?
No, Ruth, it is not only the HR staff's role to address poor behaviour, but everyone in an organisation. This is because there are duties under both legislation and common law, including penalties for breach of these duties in relation to WHS. And these apply to the board of a company, its executives, as well as the HR staff and individual workers. At common law, businesses also have a duty of care to take reasonable steps to prevent foreseeable harm to workers, including psychological harm. This involves addressing risks to mental health arising from workplace conditions, interactions between staff, and organizational practices. The model WHS law imposes a duty on businesses to eliminate or minimize risks to workers' mental health arising from the workplace as far as reasonably practicable. There is a distinction between the roles of officers in a business and the role of individual workers. Board members have a duty to exercise due diligence to ensure the company is complying with its duties under WHS law, including understanding hazards and risks in the company's operations, keeping up to date with WHS matters, ensuring there are appropriate resources and processes to eliminate or minimize risks to health and safety, including psychosocial risks, and ensuring there are appropriate processes to receive and consider information about work-related incidents, hazards, and risks, and respond efficiently and effectively to them. The executive will have similar duties to the board, although an added feature, due to often more direct involvement with staff is actively demonstrating appropriate workplace culture and role modeling for senior managers and junior employees. HR's role is more about preventing hazards in the workplace, including psychosocial hazards, especially bullying, by monitoring the risks of these hazards arising. HR will also receive and investigate complaints. And this may include obtaining external investigation assistance where it is required, for example, where an HR person is implicated in the complaint. Each worker, whether an employee or a contractor, has duties under WHS law to take reasonable care for their own health and safety and that of others who may be affected by their acts or omissions. Essentially, there is a duty to mitigate against risks. Workers can also be held liable for their own poor behaviour or as an accessory. So, what can be done and why should employers address bad behaviour? We have put some of the main reasons on the slide why employers should prioritise addressing bad behaviour in the workplace, and some of these will inevitably overlap. From a financial perspective, an organization will be more profitable where there are less cultural issues and conflict in the workplace. A good workplace environment will mean that employees are happy working in the organization, and this means employees will want to stay there and less resourcing will be needed for training new staff. It also means employees will be more productive because they are happy where they work and are not preoccupied by issues of bullying, harassment, or other poor behavior in the workplace. And the organization can generate more revenue by focusing on its core business with the help of experienced employees. Likewise, by retaining a good reputation as an employer of choice, the organization can recruit new talent to improve and expand its business. In terms of dealing with claims, whether at the early stages internally or all the way to Fair Work Commission and courts and tribunals, it can be very costly for an organization, as well as time-consuming for numerous employees involved, including managers, HR, and the board. Addressing bad behaviour in the workplace reduces the risks of claims of bullying, harassment and discrimination, and workers' compensation for mental injury, which frees up time and money for organisation. In terms of what can be done to address a negative workplace culture, a starting point for an organisation should be to identify its values and then align any policies and processes with the values of your organisation. In order to be effective in addressing cultural issues, your organisation should set measurable goals of how you intend to improve the workplace culture. And this includes setting priorities for your organisation with reference to those values, having short-term and long-term plans, and establishing metrics by which the organisation can assess the effectiveness of different strategies that have been adopted. Employers should use those tools that we referred to earlier, including feedback from employees and potentially external review, as well as monitoring claims, to regularly identify any bad employee behaviour that contributes to a negative workplace culture. And as we've said previously, it is very important to monitor any bullying, harassment complaints, workers' compensation claims for mental injury, and trends employees taking extended sick leave, or sometimes identified as stress leave, and complaints made of other negative behaviour. And this will assist your organisation in assessing whether any further investigation needs to take place, and if a wider cultural review is required. Reporting to the board is also important, and executives should report any concerns about workplace culture to the board to ensure it's meeting its obligations and is having appropriate oversight. One helpful tip is to have a standing agenda item at board meetings regarding workplace culture, and this is to ensure it is being addressed on a regular basis. An organisation should also be proactive in conducting regular risk assessments to identify any social, psychosocial hazards and problems in the systems of work. Similarly, organisations should conduct regular reviews of its workplace culture as a whole and think about whether any changes that have been made are working or not. Policies should be regularly reviewed to ensure they adequately address procedures for employee complaints, and also set out the expectations for employee behaviour in your workplace. It's important to remind employees to read these policies as they're introduced or amended. In terms of training, there should be regular training, but also with a focus on particular groups of employees. For example, separating the training for managers and the employees under their supervision, and having distinct training for the board and at the executive level for CEO and CFO. These training sessions should not be limited to onboarding, but a review should be taken to see which training sessions are worth having annually and which ones can be done as new issues arise.
Adam, just on that staff training, I think it's also important to remember that if you feel as though employees are not engaged in the particular training, it's not a sign that you need to abandon the training. Just look at it that perhaps a different style of training needs to be provided. So if you've previously done something that was online, maybe taking it in-house, maybe changing up the groups of people who are attending the training. The training sessions are really important. If it doesn't work the first time, then try something different.
Yes, and I think having the in-person training can be a lot more effective sometimes than if it's just done online. It's important that an organisation has clear timeframes for addressing complaints or bad behaviour, although they don't need to be as prescriptive in organisation policies. It's still important that any bad behaviour is addressed consistently from complaint to complaint, and there is no unnecessary delay in responding and resolving complaints.
Yeah, Adam, I think that's really important too. We see that regularly in the complaints that we investigate, but, and also workers' compensation claims, that a failure to address complaints in a timely fashion can add to the injury of the employee and to add to the employee's sense of abandonment by their employer. And in addition to that, employers can often wish to avoid difficult conversations and sort of hope that maybe if they ignore a problem, it will go away. Things very rarely are fixed on their own, and a failure to address problems is actually, you miss out on an opportunity to nip something in the bud, and then it creates a bigger problem for tomorrow.
Yes, exactly, Ruth. And sometimes this can even lead to bringing on litigation or reports to regulators and having big investigations into an organisation, which is something you don't want. In terms of dealing with complaints when they arise, the different methods can be used depending on the context. So sometimes by way of investigation, that can be managed internally by HR and in-house legal counsel. And then there are times where it'll be necessary to brief external counsel to conduct an investigation. And this may also help prevent a complainant from making allegations of bias or lack of procedural fairness in the investigation. Mediation can also be a helpful tool where conflicts arise in the workplace between individuals. And that can be an informal mediation internally or a more formal external mediation using professional mediators. It is important to consider if mediation is appropriate and avoid using it if it might aggravate any conflict further. And employers should ensure that those in charge of managing complaints are speaking directly with the employees and providing opportunities to respond to any complaints or allegations, both orally and in writing. Should also be kept in mind that deeper structural issues may need to be addressed, and this may require wider consultation with employees. And although there may not necessarily be short-term gains from such structural changes, it can facilitate a long-term improvement in the organization's workplace culture. On the slide, we've put two examples of external reviews that have recently been undertaken. The first one, which we referred to earlier, is Rio Tinto's review in 2022, and the follow-up progress review in 2024, which assessed the implementation of each recommendation and identified progress that had been made. The 2024 review outlined the key areas of progress in relation to Rio Tinto's workplace culture overall, but it did not measure the effectiveness of each of the 26 recommendations. And then on the right, there is the report into sexual harassment in the retail sector by Australia's National Research Organisation for Women's Safety, ANROWS, which was published in June 2024. This report helped uncover the prevalence of sexual harassment in the retail sector and provide recommendations on how to address this issue. In late November 2024, the Australian Retailers Association and National Retail Association welcomed the research from ANROWS report. However, the ARA Chief Industry Affairs Officer Fleur Brown also said some of the details of the recommendations will also need to be closely examined to ensure they are practical and effective. The Retail Employee Safety Council was formed in August 2024, shortly after the report was released, and this included union representatives and the peak employer body for retailers. And recently in December 2024, the Retail Employee Safety Council gathered to discuss strategies to improve retail workers' safety during the festive season, focusing on preventing abuse, assaults, and harassment. This included advocating for training to enhance employee safety, legislative reform at a state level, and improvements to reporting systems to prevent underreporting of incidents. We've included these two reviews to show the contrast between a single organisation cultural review and one at a wider sector level. In both cases, there has been follow-up from the external reviews. After 2 years, Rio Tinto was able to have a follow-up report released on progress and the implementation of the recommendations. There has been less time since the release of ANROWS report, However, engagement by employer peak bodies to prevent sexual harassment in the retail sector is already apparent. Implementing change at this wider sector level will, of course, pose more challenges when compared to a single organisation or workplace.
So finally, Julia, I'm just conscious of time, but are there any legal impediments or things that employees should be aware of when they are introducing change? So they've decided that there's some problems with the culture and there's some measures that they want to implement to help improve the culture. Is there anything that they need to be mindful of? Surely I don't need to be worried about just offering some more training sessions or holding a discussion with employees about our values.
Yeah, Ruth, there are a few legal impediments that can arise when addressing cultural change, particularly on a larger scale. And I'll try and go through these as quickly as possible, given the time we have left. But a few of the main ones are, you know, consultation. There are, of course, requirements under awards and enterprise agreements and where these apply to employees. You need to be mindful of the requirement to consult on major workplace changes. It may also be that as a result of reviewing the workplace culture, more stringent workplace surveillance is required. And if that is the case, employers should really be considering whether their standard employment contracts or company policies set out the parameters of any workplace surveillance. Policies can be changed if needed to reflect this, but employers should be putting some attention to existing employment contracts and new employment contracts to basically address whether there is a need to update those workplace surveillance clauses. Employers should also consider whether there are any changes that may be limited by existing discrimination laws, or proposed changes, I should say, at a federal or state/territory level. It might be appropriate to actually seek some external advice when implementing changes that may have these impacts, as there could be some hidden risks of indirect or direct discrimination present. And similarly, employers should consider laws relating to victimization following any changes that may lead to increased levels of workplace complaints. As we've seen from the Rio Tinto report, you know, if employees are more comfortable raising complaints, complaints will go up. And there, as a result, there might be a higher risk of victimization against those complainants. So it is a bit of a balancing act here. But apart from that, Ruth, you also spoke earlier about some proactive steps employers could take to maybe address some of the early signs of poor workplace behavior. If doing that, it's also important to bear in mind some of the legal risks associated with having those legal discussions. So, you know, for example, if you're querying an employee's recent period of sick leave, keep in mind the adverse action provisions of the Fair Work Act and that it is a workplace right for employees to take their accrued sick leave. Or if you're suggesting to an employee that they might be engaging in some sort of risky behavior, make sure that you consider the delegates' rights clauses that are now contained in modern awards and enterprise agreements, as employees may be entitled to have delegates present when you're having those discussions. So there's some of the key legal considerations for employers. But other than that, Ruth, I'll pass it back to you to finish us off for today.
Thanks, Julia. Some really helpful tips there. Just one other issue. Today it has on quite a few occasions we've talked about psychosocial risks, and that is something that often comes up in the context of workplace culture and also employee bad behaviour. Our webinar series is still available to people, and or the webinar series that we've presented over the years is still available. And we presented a very helpful session in 2023, which dealt with psychosocial hazards, and in particular, with some tips on how to conduct risk assessments and addressing those risks. So for those of you who are keen to understand more about assessing your psychosocial risks, feel free to check that webinar out. Otherwise, thank you very much for joining us. And on behalf of Adam and Julia and myself, have a great afternoon. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.